Curtis Hill isn't going anywhere. A familiar dispute in the hate crimes debate. That, plus employers say there aren't enough skilled workers, and more. On Indiana Week in Review, for the week ending November 30th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
Republican legislative leaders say it's very unlikely the General Assembly will take any steps to remove Attorney General Curtis Hill from office.
Four women accused Curtis Hill of groping them at a party in March. An investigation by the Indiana Inspector General backed up those women's accounts. But a special prosecutor opted not to bring a criminal case against the AG, and Republican Senator Mark Mesmer says anything further will be up to the voters.
There won't be any legislative action to force him out. If he's not been convicted of a felony, there's no real reason to move that issue, forward.
There's also a new debate over whether the legislature should make Attorney General an appointed rather than elected position. Speaker Brian Bosma says he supports the idea, but not right now.
The message that might send right now would be one that I think would not be well received, perhaps by the public as well, certainly as certain elected officials.
In a statement about the appointment idea, Hill says, quote, there will always be those who prefer to concentrate the levers of government in the hands of a powerful few, but I believe most Hoosiers value the freedom of electing their public servants by casting ballots.
Will anything happen to Curtis Hill this session? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Elise Schrock, is Curtis Hill in the clear?
No, I don't think he is. And I have to say I disagree with Senator Mesmer when he says there's no good reason to move forward on trying to remove him, because there are four very good reasons, and it's four victims that still have to go to work every single day in that state house with someone who has used their power to intimidate them and make them feel uncomfortable. It's an HR issue. It's a political issue. The speaker seems to think that it's a distraction to not proceed moving forward with removing him from office. I think it's a distraction to not do anything. It's going to be there either way. All state house leaders, for the most part, agree he should be removed. They have the power to do so. So shoot your shot, guys.
Is it as Brian Bosma says, would it be a major distraction to remove Curtis Hill?
I agree in part with Elise. I mean, Org Day was an obvious example of how this is going to be a distraction no matter what. Either way, whether Democrats try to bring an impeachment proceeding, this civil suit moves forward, and then you have, we're in that cycle in 2020 where the Attorney General is elected. And so there's a political pursuit. I understand legislative leaders saying, the criminal lane, the criminal conviction lane or pursuing that conviction is now closed. There's the civil lane that we're following and a political lane. I understand them, their opinion when they say, or their perspective when they say, voters are just going to have to decide this. We're in that cycle now. 2020 is next year, and voters have the opportunity to decide. We don't know if Curtis Hill is going to run for re-election yet. He hasn't indicated that. This announcement or this gaffe, we'll call it, by the Indiana Chamber to open up now this idea that we're going to turn this into an appointed position, or that there's even a possibility for that, which no one was talking about, was incredibly clumsy and gave Curtis Hill the opportunity to do what he's gotten really good at, which is kind of message that it's me against the world in Indianapolis, it's me against Indianapolis political elites. And so I think the distractions in this are ceaseless, but I do appreciate legislative leaders trying to keep at least the legislative process clear of, an impeachment bill they've got to deal with on the floor of the House or the Senate.
The message now out of Republican leaders is we're going to leave it up to the voters. Now, that voters wouldn't get a shot if Curtis Hill runs for re-election until November of 2020 because there's no primary for the AG. That's decided at the Republican convention. Let me ask this. Can Curtis Hill survive the Republican, or actually, can they force Curtis Hill out at the Republican convention is probably the way you should ask.
Certainly that would be their best opportunity, I think, from a practical standpoint, logistical standpoint. You have, as has been noted already, and you pointed out in the introduction, Brandon, that most every big-name Republican elected official has called for his departure under whatever means, his resignation, I suppose. And those people will presumably hold sway with a lot of the people, the delegates at the state convention. So that's the time to do it. As far as anything in the interim, and I'm not saying whether he should or shouldn't go, but as a practical political matter or legal matter, I think the window has closed. I think that not only because a special prosecutor has looked at it and said nothing to prosecute, not only because the inspector general...
Or not worth prosecuting.
Or not worth prosecuting. But again, there are no criminal charges, which certainly what might have hastened this. And now we're in a time where there's only so much bandwidth. Yes, it'll be a disruption, and yes, it will come up in the context of a lot of discussions involving the legislature as we move forward with the session. But other issues are going to move to the forefront, budget issues, and there will be a lot of fights that his critics probably, if the window for him to be removed was going to occur, it's prior to the session, because then everybody's going to be busy with other priorities.
Let me ask the question this way to you, Nikki. Does Eric Holcomb have the muscle, one, and two, the desire to make sure that Curtis Hill isn't the Republican nominee for Attorney General?
I don't think he has that desire. I just think that's one that he would just leave up to the rank and file. And to be very honest, the lawmakers I talk to and the people sort of out and about in the state, not in the bubble of Indianapolis, they don't seem to care. I mean, the fact is that we're at a point with the Curtis Hill situation where it has been branded in such a way that, well, he didn't commit a crime, so it's okay, which is a really interesting thing. I mean, basically, I guess now our ideals for elected officials are, as long as they don't break the law, they're good.
Which is really unfortunate, because it really is, at the heart of the matter, an HR issue for the legislature. The victims, I mean, we can talk about Curtis Hill. I understand the political implications, but there's also an HR implication, and this sends a message from the legislature that, A, women don't have a clear means of reporting. The way it was handled was by both parties was not ideal. We didn't fix it with any type of ethics bill or pamphlet that has come out yet.
Yeah, it might still be coming.
It's most of what's been done has been behind closed doors. This remains an issue from the legislature, not just because it's political, but because the victims work there. This is their workplace, and they deserve some attention because of that.
But I think if the General Assembly, if this were somebody who worked, if this were counsel to the majority or parliamentarian,
we wouldn't have this discussion.
But because it's an independently elected official, there is a bit of nuance here. And I would just say for those who, the civil litigation as it proceeds, yes, it will be yet another headline generator and distraction creator, but regardless of the outcome, that wouldn't necessarily force his removal either. It might be some sort of settlement or monetary settlement, but that anybody who's looking to that as the way to get him out of office is going to be disappointed.
We'll debate at the General Assembly in the upcoming session over a hate crimes bill will likely revolve around two words, gender identity.
Hate crimes bills of the last few sessions included the phrase gender identity on the list of protected characteristics. That drew the ire of religious conservative groups and largely helped lead to the bill's defeat. Speaker Brian Bosma says he personally supports a bill that uses the definition of bias crime already in state law, one that doesn't include gender identity. He says advocates should fight for transgender protections in the future.
As society changes, so do their representatives.
Republican Senator Mark Messmer says a hate crimes bill that passed the Senate only 2 years ago included gender identity.
It wouldn't be a deal breaker, I don't believe, in the Senate to have it in there.
Mike O'Brien, we've been having this debate in earnest for about three sessions now. This will be our fourth. Has anything really changed?
Sure. There's been obvious new cases of hate crimes being committed in Indiana. Governor Eric Holcomb put his support behind this legislation. We have 21 new legislators, a lot of them who are young people, on both sides. And this language has already passed one of these chambers. A lot of these people are already on record on this language.
And yet that hasn't stopped them the last two sessions of it getting less and less far.
That's sure. But I think we're 2 years removed from that. I think we do have these high-profile scenarios, the synagogue in Carmel being kind of first and foremost in people's minds. I think this is going to be a different debate. I don't think the elements of evangelical activists and LGBT activists are going to be any different. It's just these new people that are coming into this building for the first time as legislators. I don't know where any of them land on it.
Do you think things change?
I think you're right. The makeup of the legislature has changed. The coalition that you see behind the hate crimes law being passed are largely religious communities. We talk about the evangelical activists, but the makeup of the alliance to pass a bias crimes legislation, that includes gender identity, is coming from a largely religious crowd as well. Evangelicals don't have the monopoly on the legislative policy. And it's because we see, gender identity in my church, one of the churches that's Christ Church Cathedral, it's in the Alliance. It's been a very outspoken and active group to include gender identity because the trans community is in crisis. The 1 in 5 Hoosier children who are trans that we know about are bullied and harassed at school. I mean, we need to be protecting this community. They need to be included, and it would be outright ironic to pass a hate crimes legislation that discriminates against them.
Mike points out that the Senate passed this bill a couple years ago, and as Mark Messmer pointed out, it included gender identity. He doesn't think that's a deal breaker on his side of the building, whereas Brian
Bosma...
Well, it's
Bosma, a deal breaker for a lot of the people in the Republican caucus. I mean, that's just the way it is. And while the people have changed and the people pushing it have changed, the physical arguments between the two sides is not any different. And the gender identity seems to be a place where Republicans, some Republicans, not all, don't want to go. Some of the ones that I have spoken to, it's almost like they think putting it in the law gives it, I guess, recognition or validity, and they don't like that.
That's the problem, right? Because the issue on gender identity has always been, it doesn't matter if you think that's real or not. If someone is, even if you believe it's not real, and someone's purporting to be transgendered, and then they're targeted and attacked for that reason, that should be protected. It doesn't matter what you as an evangelical Christian really believe about that being real for that person. It should be protected because that person was deliberately attacked for that purpose. I just don't understand. Except that they can't give any daylight on that, because then it opens the door. Well, now we can't fire them from work or kick them out of their house or do the other things in the Civil Rights Act or any of that we've tried to do in the past. And it's an unfortunate line in the sand that makes no sense to me from a policy standpoint.
It seems to me that supporters of this bill are hamstrung by almost the branding or the nomenclature, the way we refer to this. We call it, of course, and everybody does, either the hate crimes law or bill or the bias crimes law. But it really, with the suggestion being, of course, and this may fuel some of the misunderstanding, that it creates a new type of crime. Like if I'm going to say mean things to you or hurt your feelings, when in fact, it still requires a crime that's already in the criminal code to occur, whether that's graffiti, whether that's it still has to be a crime. This is simply an enhancement that can be applied to sentencing. And so I think that, even though we talk about it, there's a perception that when you create a hate crimes or bias crimes law, you're somehow creating a new criminal violation. And I think that misunderstanding, which I'm sure there are opponents who don't do anything to
dissuade them from thinking that,
but I think that would be a hurdle that, if overcome, would probably lead to quicker passage.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will a hate crimes bill pass in the 2019 legislative session? A, yes, B, no, or C, too early to tell. Our question from 2 weeks ago, do you approve of Governor Eric Holcomb's job performance? 43% say yes, 43% say no, and 14% don't know or don't have an opinion. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, more than half of employers in an Indiana Chamber of Commerce survey say they left positions unfilled in the last year because of underqualified applicants.
The Chamber says the number of employers in its annual survey who reported issues with unskilled workers has risen for 5 consecutive years, and 80% of employers say a more skilled workforce is one of the biggest issues they face. In response, the Chamber launched the Institute for Workforce Excellence. It's meant to connect employers with training tools and resources to help skill up workers, to serve, as the Chamber suggests, as a middleman between businesses and the government. Only a third of supervisors or managers are trained on how to detect drug misuse or abuse. And if a worker fails a drug test, more than half of employers say they're more likely to terminate the employee than to refer them to treatment.
Nikki Kelly, what do you take away from this latest survey?
Unfortunately for lawmakers, what I take away is that what they've been doing for the last 10 years hasn't done anything. I mean, they're trying. They're trying everything in the wheelhouse, but nothing is moving the needle. Every year we have yet another workforce development bill or two or three. And, you know, and we're going to have another one this year. So unfortunately for them, it's just not working.
And not just another bill or variation on the, you know, a new theme, but the messaging and the attempt is the same. It's always about streamlining, about consolidating various programs that are administered across any number of agencies. 54, I think, programs were recognized in the most recent count.
That the state 30 different agencies.
And 30 different agencies, some of which can track their outcomes and some of which can't, which is another problem. But I remember back to Evan Bayh's administration when he first took office. It was, you know, this big news conference. Here, we're going to finally bring all these agencies together, boom. And then subsequent administrations, we're going to bring all these agencies together, boom. So I don't know if it's just like fungus that it just starts, you know, no, you can't kill it. It just keeps growing. But clearly that's the holy grail here, is figuring out a way to centralize these efforts.
So a lot of the chamber's message was with this new institute is connecting employers to training programs and things like that. Do we also have to start asking the question as to whether or not we're paying workers enough?
So yes, and one of the ways that you fix that is by training them up to fill these positions that are worth those dollars. I think Governor Eric Holcomb's Next Level Jobs program has been great in that it's a portal that is updated regularly. I looked at it this morning; it had 46,000 jobs on it, and the hourly income was $15 to $64 an hour, and they'll reimburse the employer for up to $50,000 to train these employees, but the people actually have to want to go do that. The problem with a lot of this is it's hard to go. Now hundreds of thousands of people have plugged into this Next Level Jobs program and are working through that process, which is great. But the people have to want to then go get a certificate in one of these high growth fields.
It's not even that they just have to want to. They have to be able to. I mean, we have left bills out to languish that senators and representatives of the legislature have tried to pass that would help with the cost of childcare. That would, I know that's kind of another way to attack this problem. We've been rearranging the deck chairs on workforce from the top down without giving Hoosier working families a chance to find childcare. We've been talking about comprehensive early education so long that the kids in preschool, when we first proposed this idea, are now coming out into the workforce and maybe could have had an edge on where we're at. So
if the Indy Chamber was sitting here, they'd tell you about mass transit, you know, and how that the connectivity of these neighborhoods to where the jobs are is.
We've been talking about top down, and we need to be giving Hoosier working families the wraparound ability and access to even getting to a job. Sometimes that's two and three steps down the line for Hoosiers.
The U.S. Supreme Court seems likely to rein in local law enforcement agencies' ability to confiscate crime suspects' property.
The case, heard this week by the High Court, centers around an Indiana man whose $40,000 Land Rover was seized by police when he was arrested for selling about $400 worth of drugs. The hearing was largely a one-sided affair in which the primary question seemed not to be whether the state could win, but how broadly it would lose. The Supreme Court has said most of the Bill of Rights applies to states as well as the federal government, but it hasn't done so for the Eighth Amendment and its ban on excessive fines. Conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch was incredulous that Indiana Solicitor General Tom Fisher urged the justices to rule that states should not be held to that standard. Fisher also agreed with a hypothetical from liberal Justice Stephen Breyer that police could confiscate the car of anyone who so much as goes more than 5 miles above the speed limit.
John Schwannis, if civil forfeiture is about to be reined in, as a lot of people now expect, what does that actually mean for local law enforcement funding?
Well, there are certainly a lot of agencies. The figure I've heard nationally, $3 billion just in the past few years. Mostly, they tend to be rural agencies that don't have the same sort of funding. But I guess there's the practical answer and the philosophical answer. Law enforcement seems to me we would all stipulate is not a for-profit venture where you're motivated by your ability to extract penalties effectively in the field. I mean, keep in mind, again, as you've noted, there's no conviction required. And in many cases, there's potentially not even a filing of charges.
Right.
You can, and so.
And they don't always have to give it back either.
That is very true. Well, the burden shifts. You know,
right.
If in criminal court, you have to prove my guilt. And if you try to get your property back, the burden is on you to prove your innocence. So it's an odd thing. And, you know, not many issues, it seems, in recent years have brought the Supreme Court together on during oral arguments. And you never want to bet on the final decision. But if this was, if there ever agreement, widespread agreement, this may have been the issue.
Yeah, that's right. At the state level, when you talk about funding for a lot of things, are they going to have to, maybe probably not in 2019 budget, but in future budgets have to start looking?
Well, yeah, I mean, local governments already struggle with the property tax caps, which this would mean they need to lean more on income taxes. And lawmakers are going to have to open up those opportunities, maybe raise the caps or, you know, make it easier to do food and beverage or other taxes.
I think a lot of people think the civil forfeiture needs serious overhaul, so that seems to be a good outcome. But are we faced with some problematic results of that?
Well, I mean, if you're going to ask me, I think the criminal justice system as a whole is going to need some reform because it disproportionately affects people of color, men of color, who end up in a system, and instead of being rehabilitated, they end up just trapped in this cycle, right? So this is a very complex and interesting part of that to look at because you have someone in a drug-related crime who has their items taken from them, in this case someone who would help them get to possibly drug rehabilitation, to their parole urine analysis test, to any type of other additional hearing, all of which that person is responsible for additionally paying for. They're going to be owing, you know, who knows how many months on a car. The car payments don't stop. So, you know, when you look at the implications that this could have on the person who's involved, does the crime match the punishment and the long-standing punishment that they could, that cycle they could be in? And I would argue that, you know, relying on this as a means to fund our law enforcement agencies means that leaders aren't adequately funding them and doing their job. Yeah.
Fundamentally, is this just something that needs to happen?
Well, there's two issues here. The proportionality question here with the U.S. Supreme Court is, can we take your $40,000 SUV for a $400 crime? Yeah. Right. That's what they're trying to figure out in the U.S. Supreme Court. What John brought up is the due process question. The Indiana legislature did a comprehensive overhaul of that this session where they tried to rebalance that burden and put it on prosecutors to say, you've got to, within a week, get in front of a judge and say why you took this person's car. If that car, or whatever your property was seized, if the owner feels that that was done inappropriately, they have the right now to petition and get that back on a provisional basis while this case is adjudicated. And so the Indiana legislature has tried to solve the half of this problem, which is the improper taking without due process. The Supreme Court will figure out the other half of this on this disproportionality of it.
All right. Well, a company using crowdsourced data to evaluate road conditions says Indiana's roads are the third worst among 37 states that were analyzed.
Level 5 creates maps for self-driving cars by collecting video footage of millions of miles of roads from people using their phone app, and the company fed that footage into an algorithm that determines road quality. That algorithm determined Indiana's roads are the third worst of the 37 states included. Indiana Department of Transportation spokesperson Scott Manning says they check all state-maintained roads every year with infrared scans, which are more detailed than crowdsourced data.
Mike O'Brien, the gas tax hike wasn't hugely unpopular here, as it turned out. Certainly not at the ballot.
That's another way to say it was popular.
It wasn't. I'm not sure I want to call a tax hike popular, but it wasn't unpopular.
Okay.
But if road conditions don't improve, we've seen a lot of construction, but if the conditions don't improve, does that start to create some unrest?
Well, first of all, this study was ridiculous. It paid people a nickel to put an iPhone dash cam on their car, and then they would just randomly pull frames of it and from different states and rank them. They didn't say what kind of roads, where they were, whatever, right? So I don't like being the guy who bangs on the bad pole for my guy, but this study was stupid. But NDOT funding has gone up. It's going up $500 million. We're going to be at almost $3 billion all in on all sources, which is a huge increase. So you're going to see a lot of investment. We're already seeing a lot of investment in Indiana roads. We're going to see better roads because of it.
Given all the work that's ongoing, is this sort of, you just kind of shrug this one off?
I don't know. I mean, you could say that the crowdsourcing technology isn't apt, but I would say if you ask most Hoosiers, that's the number one issue we have, like, legislators hear about. That's the number one issue city councilors hear about. Them. Everyone hears about.
Everyone hates it.
No, about...
We all know what you meant.
You know what I mean. And,
I'm trying not to lose here.
Threw me off with Sorry. That. That's okay.
Good strategy. That's a pretty good
strategy. And on that note,
hey,
our roads still need some work. 50% of the state funding went to state roads. 90% of the roads are local.
Yeah,
locals
right.
still need some help.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.